Good morning again, everybody. Go ahead and have a seat. This morning, we're going to be talking about somebody that I'm fascinated by, and we're going to look at how his life lends itself to where we've been. Because we normally do an introduction, and we didn't do that this morning, we've been talking about spiritual disciplines, and we have a series called Abstinence and Action, and the idea is that there are certain things we give up, sometimes very good things like speech and money, to practice things like silence and solitude, fasting. We give up food to practice fasting. So we've been talking about things that we give up. Next week begins our conversation into things that we add, the action part of the abstinence and action. And today we're talking about secrecy, we're talking about sacrifice, and we're talking about a guy by the name of Henry Nouwen. And I'm fascinated by his life. Anybody familiar with Henry Nouwen? Okay, a couple people. So Henry Nouwen, he's an author, he's a Catholic priest, he was a professor, he was a renowned theologian. He was born in 1932 in the Netherlands, and he went from there, he studied at a variety of Jesuit universities, and he became a priest in 1957, so he's about 25 years old. He becomes a Jesuit priest, and the typical course of study for a Jesuit priest is theology, right? You want them to understand from a theological perspective what they're priesting about, right? How they're supposed to teach. But Henry Nouwen was more than theology, and he loved theology, but he was fascinated with the human condition, with people. And so he asked for and was granted a release from studying theology, and instead he went to study psychology. And being that he was a priest, beginning in 1957, in the late 50s and the early 60s, something was happening in America that was kind of the pinnacle of the time of social justice issues as they were studying psychology, and that's the early days of the civil rights movement, or maybe as the civil rights movement was really bubbling up to a head. And so in 1965, Nouwen was so entrenched in this idea that people need civil rights, we need liberties, and racism is bad, right? So he went from where he was stationed at the time over in Europe to America in 1965, and he joined Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. At Selma. So if you guys saw the movie Selma that came out a couple years ago, and it talked about the story, the marches from Selma to Montgomery, those places are familiar when we think about Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights discourse we've had and some of the action that's happened. Henry Nouwen traveled in 1965 to Alabama, and he marched to Montgomery from Selma with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That all happened about 3 years before Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. In 1966, Henry Nouwen became a professor of theology at Notre Dame. So while he studied psychology, he ended up landing in this position of teaching people about theology at one of the biggest universities, one of the most renowned universities in the world, Notre Dame. That was in 1966. In 1971, he accepted a position of professor of pastoral theology at Yale. So Notre Dame apparently wasn't good enough, and he jumped ship to Yale. In 1981, he was able to take this trip down to Latin America, and he got to spend some time with some people who didn't have the resources to go to Notre Dame or Yale to be able to take some of his theology classes and to learn about psychology, and he learned about poverty, financial poverty, in a really unique way, because the people that he was teaching at these other colleges, they weren't exactly cut from the same cloth as the people that he was ministering to down in Latin America. Are you with me? Good. All right. So from there, he was asked to come and to be a professor of divinity at Harvard. So Notre Dame to Yale to Harvard. And that was in 1983. He said, okay, I'll take this position at Harvard, but I need 6 months a year off. And I need to go spend time with the people of Latin America so I can continue to teach them and to learn from them and to invest in them, because they don't have the opportunity to be able to learn like people do in America and even when I was in Europe. And so they said, okay, we love you. You're renowned. You've written all these books and done these amazing things. He had 2 pre-doctoral degrees. And so he landed at Harvard. He only taught there from 83 to 85. And he experienced crippling depression, because he decided everything that he was doing in life, trying to seek God, trying to understand what God wanted for him, he's trying and he's so motivated to do these things, but he just wasn't happy. Just didn't feel like Didn't feel like he was doing the work of God in the place that God wanted him to do that work, except for those times when he was in Latin America teaching people that were in utter financial ruin. So he resigned his position from Harvard, and he went to spend some time at a place called the L'Arche community in France. L'Arche means the ark, and his friend Jean Vanier had started the L'Arche community. And what the L'Arche community is a community of severely mentally handicapped, mentally disabled people, and their caretakers. And it's really just like a little city. It's not with the goal of trying to get people with Down syndrome to not have Down syndrome anymore, right? It's trying to get people in to have a community and to have a real life. So he saw this. He lived here for about 9 months with his friend, and at some point, something happened at a L'Arche community in Toronto. There's about 40 of them around the world. And they said, we need a pastor to come and to do something here to moderate, to mediate a situation. A family that lived there had experienced a death at the hands of some of the people who worked there. And so they needed a pastoral presence to come in. And Jean Vanier said, hey, Henry Nouwen, you should go do this. So he does, and he moderates the situation with such beauty that they say, would you stay? Would you be willing to give up your position at Harvard or Yale or Notre Dame or any of these accolades that you've chased your whole life? And would you stay? Would you be our pastor? That was in 1986. And he said yes. And he stayed there for 10 years until his completely unexpected death by severe heart attack in 1996. He just died one day. What's fascinating about this story to me is that somebody that's so intrinsically motivated to be a priest, a professor of theology, a professor of divinity, a doctoral candidate in psychology, a doctoral candidate in pastoral theology, somebody that's employed by Notre Dame and then Yale and then Harvard, as well as guest spots and guest speaking rotations around the world, somebody that's authored 39 books that have been translated into 30 different languages that have sold millions and millions and millions of copies. Somebody who's put more theological teachers into the world than any of us will ever be taught by. He's trained those people, those minds. Why was somebody like this still seeking? Why was somebody like this still trying to figure the answer? What's pretty astounding is that he found the answer in a place filled with people that were nothing similar to the people that he had been teaching his whole life, except for those times that he spent in Latin America or that 9 months that he spent at the L'Arche community in France. How many people with severe mental handicaps, mental disabilities, do you think Henry Nouwen taught at Harvard? How many people do you think went through his doctoral of theology program at Yale? Zero. It's pretty safe to say I would put actual real money on this. I'm not going to bet on the Conor McGregor, Floyd Mayweather fight, but I would bet on this, right? That, yeah, I'm going to say zero. Zero people went through his classes at Harvard or Yale or Notre Dame. That's a Hollywood story, right? When people with severe mental disabilities end up in college, it's usually trade schools or a life skill college, a community college, and it's not a place where they're taking the same classes as everyone else. It's a place where they're learning life skills. They're learning how to cohabitate with other people who can function at a high level enough with the similar kind of mental disabilities and their caretakers, right? So I'm not trying to be condemning. I'm not trying to be harsh. I'm just trying to paint the picture that it is what it is. That's where we are in the world, is we're at a place where the people who can't get over a certain bar intellectually are pretty marginalized. But Henry Nouwen found his passion and his pursuit and the calling of Christ in serving these people, and not at Yale and not at Harvard and not anywhere else in the world, not Notre Dame, not in his doctoral degrees, not in his accolades, not in the books, but in his time that he spent at L'Arche Daybreak in Toronto, Canada. So much so that Henry Nouwen had become a prominent figure because he'd written and he'd taught all over. But it wasn't until he was interviewed in 1994 by Christianity Today magazine that he came forward and said, you know, the Henry Nouwen that you know is not the Henry Nouwen that I am anymore. And he says this in the interview. This is the interviewer talking. Article from 1994, 2 years before Henry Nouwen's death. It says, Nouwen insists that those who want to understand him must encounter L'Arche. Interviewers are encouraged to spend time at Daybreak, absorbing its unique dynamics. And that's what this interviewer did. He came and he spent 6 weeks with them, just walking the walk, meeting people, serving in similar ways to Henry Nouwen. He told me, so this is Henry Nouwen speaking, Le'Arche exists not to help the mentally handicapped get normal, but to help them share their spiritual gifts with the world. The poor of spirit are given to us for our conversion. The poor of spirit are given to us for our conversion. Let that sink in. In their poverty, the mentally handicapped reveal God to us and hold us close to the gospel. Many times as he travels now and brings along one or more handicapped members to his speaking engagements, I'm not just Henry Nouwen anymore, he often says. Because it would be impossible to define him apart from where he found his own identity. So wait a minute. A guy that's worked so hard for all of these positions and all of these advanced degrees and at some of the biggest, brightest, best universities in the whole world. This is a guy that's telling us he is not that guy. I imagine the conversation back and forth between people trying to figure out Henry Nouwen, like doctoral students who read his books. Oh, you know Henry Nouwen? Well, who's Henry Nouwen? You know the guy, he's the author? No, I don't think I know that guy. Well, you know the guy who taught at Yale? Henry Nouwen from Yale? No, I don't know him. Henry Nouwen, you know, from Harvard, he taught divinity and theology at Notre Dame. You know that one? No, I don't think I know that guy. Well, what Henry Nouwen do you know? Oh, I know the pastor. Henry Nouwen, the pastor at Daybreak. He works with mentally handicapped people. That's how Henry Nouwen wanted to be known. That's how Henry Nouwen found his identity. Was in this, going to this quiet place, kind of in secret, kind of off the grid, out of his path of beaten travel, being submissive to God, listening to God. Let's be brutally honest. How many of us want to work so hard our whole life for accolades, to build our businesses, to raise our families in a strong and godly and healthy way, to make a ton of money and to work real hard to provide for our family and the next generation? How many of us want to do that so that somebody can identify us by something that seems so submissive to those things? None of us do. All of us want to seek accolades. All of us want to seek the power and the renown that comes from doing big, big things. We don't want to go to a place where we're in charge of an area of people that have to fail an intelligence test to become members. Like, that doesn't seem like a place where we're going, yeah, this is what I'm striving to do, right? And I'm not trying to be harsh. And I'm not trying to marginalize. But what I am trying to do is to get us to understand what's happened that a guy like this would want to go to a place like that. Because it's counter to the way that we live. It's counter to the way that we're taught. Work hard. Raise money. Be the best. Climb the ladder. Then you'll be successful. But what Henry Nouwen did was the opposite. He climbed the ladder all the way to the top. He couldn't get much higher than he got. And it's widely known that Henry Nouwen struggled with depression, anger, sexuality, orientation, things like that during that time. He was confused while he was there until he landed at Daybreak, a place where the titles and the accolades and the degrees and the awards, those people didn't care about that. What did they care about? They cared that he was willing to spend time with them. That he was willing to get to know them, that he was willing to learn about their story and to share what he could of his knowledge with them and to try to seek Jesus together. That's the core component of the Le'Arche community, is that we'd seek to live Christian lives for people that have a harder time doing it in the regular, everyday churning of the world. So today we're talking about the spiritual disciplines of secrecy and submission. So it's interesting that this guy who had the potential to do so many big and bold things took this hard left turn into this place where he's away from these giant universities and such, and now we celebrate him. We know Henry Nouwen now as somebody who did this thing. And he didn't do it because he wanted the reward and the accolades. He did it because he was trying to be obedient to Jesus. And it seems to me like we know him more because of his time at Le'Arche. He wrote some of his most powerful books being there. And we celebrate these things that he did in submission and really secrecy to exit that academic world and go to this place where nobody would celebrate those things. We know of him because he was willing to do that. The Bible's full of exhortations to do certain things secretly, as well as it's full of admonishments that the bad things that we do secretly are going to be exposed when the light comes. The Bible tells us in Matthew 6 that we're supposed to give money in secret. In Matthew 6, verse 1, it says, "Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do." We talk about hypocrites a lot. "Do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." So we're told to give in secret, to be financially generous in secret, not in a way that brings acclaim to ourselves. We're told to pray in secret in the next verse, Matthew 6, 5. "And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites." It's that word again. "For they love to pray, standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Oh, Lord, do these amazing things," looking around to see if anybody's looking. "Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what's done in secret, will reward you." We pray in secret. We give in secret. Just 2 weeks ago, we talked about fasting. So this verse will be familiar to you if you were with us. We fast in secret. Matthew 6, 16 says, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do." There's that word again. "For they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you." So we give financially, we fast, we pray in secret, but we also sin in secret too, don't we? All of us have ways that we sin in secret. Ephesians chapter 6 says, For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness. Don't be in the dark place where we sin, but rather expose them. It's shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible, and everything that is illuminated becomes a light. The idea behind both of these things is that good things, bad things, sin, and the ways that we obey God's commandments, those are things that we do in secret. And God comes in and he reveals them. His light shines on these things. It's interesting too because there are 12 references in the Bible to living in the shadow of God. Specifically, there are other references. Most of us are familiar with Psalm 23. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," right? I don't walk into death, I'm walking in the valley that's in the shadow of it. There are 12 references that talk about the shadow. It was interesting to me because living in the shadow of God is not, it's not a mechanism that a lot of us interact with. But there are so many passages that talk about it. Psalm 17, and these are all from the book of Psalms. Psalm 17, 8 says, "Keep me as the apple of your eye, hide me in the shadow of your wings from the wicked who are out to destroy me, from my mortal enemies who surround me, the shadow of your wings." It's protecting. "How priceless," Psalm 36, 7, "how priceless is your unfailing love, O God. People take refuge in the shadow of your wings." Psalm 57, 1, "I have mercy on me, my God, have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed." Psalm 63, 6 says, "On my bed I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night, because you are my help. I sing in the shadow of your wings. I cling to you. Your right hand upholds me." The book of Isaiah has verses that talk about spending time in the shadow of God's protections, in the shadow of a great rock, or the shadow of his hand. The Bible talks about God being giving us a shadow for the heat, or a shadow from the day. We heard the word refuge in almost every one of those verses from Psalms. And the idea behind this whole thing makes me think of two things specifically. First, living in God's shadow means that we aren't leading the way. Because if we're in the lead, we're cast in the shadow. We're not being covered by the shadow. Living in God's shadow means that we aren't leading the way. God's in the lead. And I get this vision of climbing a trail, hiking a trail, right? And whoever's in the lead, which it should be Christ ahead of us, right, is casting a shadow on the person behind us. And we're tempted sometimes to lean out ahead or to run ahead and pave the way, right, and to get out from behind whoever's blazing the trail, who should be God in front of us, because, you know, we want to experience those things. We want to go and we want to get to places where we say, oh, hey, look, I think we should go this way, and I think we should travel down this path. But if we're running ahead of God, we're putting ourselves in a place where we're not seeing things from God's perspective. We're only seeing things from our own perspective. And if we get too overeager, a lot of times we run around God and we get to a place and we say, hey, everybody, come this way. And this isn't the way that God would lead. So we have a tendency of leading wrong if we don't stay in the shadow of God. Living in God's shadow means that we aren't leading the way, that we are submissive to God's leadership, even when we can't see around him, that we find a place of comfortability in God's shadow as we move ahead. And we trust that God's not going to lead us into a dangerous place. So the first thing that I think about is that living in God's shadow means that we aren't leading the way. The second thing that I think about is living in the protection of God's shadow means not only is God leading the way, but by leading the way, God's protecting us from the brunt of the damage being done by the wind and the rain and the sun and the elements that are beating down, that are allowing us to experience the shadow. Have you ever been in a place where you're having a conversation with somebody, maybe at a coffee house, maybe in your house, maybe as you're driving, and like as their head moves or as your head moves, like you get blasted with a million lumens of sunlight right in your face, and you like quickly try to put yourself back in put their head in the way of the sun that's shining through, right? Like it hurts. And it's nowhere near the damage that could be coming to you if God wasn't there in the front protecting you, allowing you to stand in his shadow, because we'd burn up. God wants to protect us by keeping us in his shadow. It's not just about leading us. It's not just about us getting lost. It's also about protecting us from getting hurt. That's what living in the shadow of God is like. When Henry Nouwen was in the throes of his priestly studies, he realized that part of the reason he wasn't happy, part of the reason he struggled with depression, is that he'd been working so hard to do the work of God that he thought he was supposed to do, but he hadn't stopped and asked God if this is where he was supposed to go. He just worked and worked and worked and worked harder than many of us ever will, or at least achieved success in a way that many of us never will. But he didn't find fulfillment of God at Yale or Harvard or Notre Dame because God wanted him to go to this quiet place, this place where nobody else wanted to go, and to be submissive, to submit himself to the leading of God to a place where there really was no notoriety to be found. And it was in that place that Henry Nouwen found that happiness that he so longed for. It was in that place that he would proclaim that you can't really know me unless you come here and you get to know these people. And you spend time with these people, because I'm not that guy anymore. I'm submissive to God's leadership, and God's called me to this quiet place to live a quiet life of leadership in secret, apart from awards and accolades, and to live in this place where I get to share God's love with people. This week, your homework is light. You guys who've been here know that I've been assigning homework every week during this series, just a little thing to practice. And I want it to be light because next week, as I mentioned, we're moving into the action phase. And so I want to gear up, prepare yourself that we're going to have a little heavier homework going forward, right? I'm going to ask you to do more things. But this week, I wanted to keep it light as we think about living lives in secrecy and submission, living lives in obedience to God, being willing to go somewhere where there's little to no renown other than what God heaps on us. So your homework this week is this. I would like you to move to a community of people with intellectual disabilities and become their pastor. That's all. Just go there, right? Henry Nouwen did it, and he had way more to give up than you guys did, right? So no, you don't need to do that. I want to encourage you to do something very, very, very simple this week. And I want you to do it every day with the expectation that God's going to reveal the answer to what you're going to ask of him on Friday or Saturday this week. And I feel really confident about this. And this is not like, I'm not a guy that goes forward and says, hey, thus saith the Lord, this is going to happen at this time in this place. Like, that's not me. I'm an interpreter of scripture. I love the Bible. I love to read. I love to learn the things that it says. But I'm rarely the guy that said, hey, I have a word from God that I need to give to you. So when I was writing this, I'm like talking with God, like, are you sure? Am I really supposed to tell these guys that on Friday or Saturday that God's going to make it really clear? And he's like, yep, I'll worry about it. I'm like, okay. So I'm telling you that if you do this thing, God's told me that he wants you to see fruition from this Friday or Saturday. So this is your homework this week. I want you to stop every day, and if you want to take out your phones and set a reminder or an alarm or something every day this week, starting today, and I want you to say this prayer, this short prayer. You ready? God, what is it that you want me to give to you? That's it. 30 seconds. Shouldn't even take that long. I mean, you got to listen. But I want you to stop before you leave for work, as you're laying down for bed, and I want you to say, God, what is it that you want me to give to you? And then on Friday or Saturday whatever as your weekend kind of wraps down, we all work different schedules. I'm really trying to make it as convenient as possible for you to see an opportunity for God to work through this. I want you to ask God, what is it that you want me to give to you? And he may say something like, Pete, I want you to sell your most expensive guitar and I want you to give money to Union Gospel Mission. And I'll say, okay, I'm going to pray about this tomorrow and see if I come up with a different answer, because I'm not sure that that's really what you're telling me, right? So I'm going to come back to God the next day and I'm going to say, God, what is it that you want me to give to you? And I want you to listen, not only how you're giving it to God, but what you do, because I want you to do it in a way that does not bring renown or acclaim to yourself. So I'm not going to go sell my most expensive guitar and then post on Facebook, hey guys, look, I just sold this. I gave $1,000 to charity. Woohoo, go me. Because that's not what secrecy and submission is about. It's about rejecting the acclaim that comes from doing good, from following God. So that's what we're going to practice this week. And then on Friday or Saturday, I don't know, maybe God's going to tell you to give money to a homeless person or to an organization. Maybe God's going to tell you to mow your neighbor's lawn secretly. Maybe God's going to tell you to bring food to a relative or call your grandma because she loves when you call, right? Maybe God's going to tell you to pick up a stranger's tab in line at Starbucks. I don't know. I don't know what God's going to tell you to do, but I know he's going to tell you to do something. And I know that something on Friday or Saturday, it's going to become clear and you're going to do it and you're going to go, wow, that was great. I saw God work through this thing in a way that I wouldn't have seen him work. Had I not done this thing, this is awesome. And you have permission, if God tells you to sell your most expensive gun or guitar or whatever, pray about it the next day too, and just make sure you're listening and doing what he says. I think it's ironic that we celebrate the accomplishment of Henry Nouwen and his secret journey of submission toward God, you know, because he went to a place that's not a place of great renown and acclaim and award. But that's in part, the mystery of God. He uses these kind of situations to encourage the rest of us. So I think it's appropriate that we celebrate them when we see them. And more than celebrating an obedient person, we celebrate what God does in those situations.